the phrase goes, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it's okay. So, information is being gathered about said duck. Three things, right? Gathering all the information. So, if you look at an animal and it has a duck bill, do you just want to assume it's a duck? Yes? Okay, all right, yes. If we do that though, have you ever heard of a platypus? All right, so if we go along and we just assume based off the appearance of a duck bill that this animal is a duck, you're liable to get slapped in the face by a beaver tail. Am I right? So let's gather all the information before we make assumptions about things. All right? Let's stop and look at it. Now, sometimes we don't have all the information. Sometimes we only get a little snippet of it, and we are forced to make assumptions, right? And we have to do that. But don't close yourself off to further information. Does that make sense? All right? Because we don't want to become so ingrained in something that we believe in, right, that we miss something, that we miss something bigger, right? So always leave yourself self-open information. Now, when you do that, that can be dangerous because, you know, obviously somebody's going to come along and insert quote here and try to throw you way off track, right? That's where the spirit of, like, discernment, that's where it takes a mind to be able to look at information and go, okay, is this valid or is this not, right? And then sort it out, right? But don't just assume that everything else that comes along that doesn't fit your box, your God box, because we're really, really good at putting God in boxes, right? That's how my brain works. I've got like 50 boxes in my closet, my mental closet. And we write it off. We miss so much, right? So keep that in mind. We are constantly bombarded by information. Made that statement a little bit ago, all right? And we're programmed to make important, precise decisions based off very little bit of information. How fast does stuff in school come at you? Pretty quick, right? Like you learn something one day, and typically the next, you're already onto something new. So if you don't understand whatever it is that's come at you that day, you're playing catch up already, just right off the bat. And then heaven forbid you miss a day of school because the homework is... At least for me, it was ridiculous. I can't do work like that, right? But we're programmed to make these decisions, and then we wonder where stress and anxiety comes from, right? Like, you guys are already hit in school with so much stress and so much anxiety, you know, passing this test, all your friends, making sure you look cool with this person, you know, don't do this said stupid thing, whatever, right? We got to wonder where all this comes. We're like, we are programmed to make important decisions off of very little bit of information. And a once great master once said that you must unlearn what you have learned. Insert Yoda voice here, by the way. I can't do it right now. But you must unlearn what you have learned, right? We've got to stop and take a second and learn how to calm our mind. To live in this thing that we call rest, right? Peace, right? So that as information comes at us, we're not making these quick, lightning, fast decisions all the time. We can actually analyze what's coming out of us and give it thought and think. So many people are just taking what's coming in and not allowing themselves to think and ponder and look at any of the information that comes at them. Like, I want to just say spiritual matters, but it's life in general, right? So, my first thing here to test this, I have a question for you. What is this? A trash bag. I just happen to work for a trash bag company. I'm an electrical guy, right? You're saying it's a trash bag. How do you know? Looks like one. All right. Trash bag. What happens? Hold this. understand this isn't going to be exact.
You should never do this without adult supervision. I have adults supervising me, so it's okay. There you go. My bad. Sorry. There. Finish putting that on. Now what is it?
Shirt.
Shirt, poncho, right? I had a whole bunch of them. What happens if I take that and I start throwing clothes in it? I use it to carry it around. Luggage, right? So, I'm gonna die if I do that. I need to move that. So what defines what that is? If you noticed, I did not have a box. I did not have a label, right? The box, the label, what the world puts on us, right, is how others see us, right? But when you look past that, you find other resources, you find other means for it, okay? So now suddenly this trash bag that we just assumed was a trash bag, there's no box, there's no label, there's nothing that defines what this is in this moment right now, except that you've seen before that it looks like a trash bag, and that's what it's been used for. But there are so many other purposes for this thing, these, that can be useful. Thank you. Right? So, let's talk about the worth of this. Let's talk about our worth. You obviously can make the connection of where I'm going with that, right? Don't let the world put labels on you, right? And even if they do, branch out. That box that the world has put you in does not define who you are, right? You define who you are. We're talking about perception, right? Understanding. I happen to know that this thing costs, I don't know, 5 cents to make. So what is its value? What is its worth? 5 cents, right? Okay. How much is your drum set worth? Throw out a number. It doesn't have to be real. You can lie. Let's say $2,000, right? Let's say $2,000, right? What happens if you leave it out in the rain and it becomes completely waterlogged and useless? Now how much is it worth? Now what does its cost?
Zero.
Zero, right? Bag's 5 cents. If I take this bag and I cover up those drums, which would be a painstaking process, I should have picked something smaller, but I cover them up effectively and it pours. The world pours on them, right? Covers it, drenches it, whatever. But this bag protects us, protects it. You see the analogy, right? Now how much is this bag worth? At least 2,000, right? Don't let the world's labels, don't let the box the world wants to put you in define your worth. Don't let the world tell you who you are and who you're gonna be, all right? Your perception is your reality. You define who you are. Christ inside of you, God inside of you, defines who you are. He defines who I am. Take pride in that. Pride's not always a bad thing. Just be real about it, right? Be confident in it. Understand the love that God has for you, right? And go walk out into that world and all the good works that we've been talking about. Go share that love. Go share that confidence that you have there with them. Don't let the world put you in a box. I'm going to skip some things because that's how the Holy Spirit works sometimes. Why is our perception important? Besides just the obvious right there, right? Like, besides defining who we are, our perception looking outwards. Once we establish inside, that's fine. Then we start looking outwards. We want to start doing good works and do things outside. What do? It's because I said our perception determines our reality, right? So specifically speaking here, God, our perception of God matters, right? Because our perception of God becomes our reality of God,
Are you following along with that? If you believe that you serve a God who is angry, who is up there with the fly swatter waiting to smite you every time that you do something wrong, that's your life. That's your perception. That is your reality, right? But if you serve a God of love, kindness, of grace, well, then that becomes your reality, right? It doesn't change who he is, but your perception of him changes, right? And how you walk out your life based off your perception, the glasses that you're wearing, the lenses that you're seeing through, is going to be how you live your life. You following along with me? I think one of the first times I ever met Michael, he used kind of this demonstration. This is a dollar. One, for anybody who can't see it, right? How much is it worth? I crunch it up. I do whatever I want to, right? The value is still the same, right? So when we go through things, we go through struggles, we go through life, right? As that happens, the value doesn't change. God has determined your value, right? Your perception of yourself, your perception of God, all of these things combined make up who you are, right? I don't want this to blow away. I'm going to set it right there. Okay? What do we face that alters our perception of ourselves, of God? There's a pandemic going on right now that nobody wants to talk about, or very few people are talking about. Michael kind of ruined that phrase for me. of shame, fear, guilt, and anxiety, right? It's running rampant, and it's not just little kids, it's not teenagers, it's adults. I see it a lot in adults. This feeling of hopelessness, that there's nothing left. And it really hinges on this shame thing, right? So I want to ask you, or I want to define really, what is the difference between shame and guilt? I'm going to take something that most people think are the same thing, and I'm going to split them up. I'm going to change the perception, right? Hopefully. I'm going to define these two things. Guilt can be useful, believe it or not. Guilt can be beneficial. When you go out and you have a test tomorrow, and you stay up all night playing the latest Call of Duty, or was it PUBG, or Halo, or just whatever, some video game, right? You stay up all night, you stay up late, whatever, you bomb the test the next day. Absolutely fail it because you're tired, you're not paying attention, whatever, right? Very practical, real scenario. At least for me it was. You feel guilty, right? Why? Because I did something stupid, right? That's guilt. I did something stupid. That's one self-talk. That's one perception of yourself. The other is I stayed up late playing video games all night. I bombed my test. Wow, I am so stupid. There's a difference. The difference between shame and guilt is I did something stupid or I am stupid. What is your self-talk? Because we all do things, right, that we're like, that was dumb. I am the king of it all the time, right? But I have developed a mentality of, wow, I did something stupid. Because you know what you can do with that? It's beneficial. Because you can go, that thing I did, I could not do again. Right? It has a place. I did that stupid thing. But when your self-talk is, I am stupid after doing something, you carry that with you. You radiate that. Right? So if we can get the perception, we can get the understanding that there's a difference, like I'm allowed to do stupid things sometimes, things that are not beneficial for me, then I can put them in their place, and I don't have to carry that burden with me everywhere I go. Does that make sense? Perception. It's interesting to me that we first see shame all the way back in the garden, right after they started eating the fruit that they weren't supposed to eat, right? The knowledge of good and evil. They saw that they were naked and they were shameful. They felt shame. And there's something very important about this encounter that takes place that I've always overlooked, right? It wasn't until they looked at themselves that they realized it and they felt shame. They'd been naked the entire time and never felt it. But it wasn't until they looked at themselves and stopped looking outwards that they started feeling shame. Does that make sense? The issue in the garden when I look at the character of God, wasn't even so much that they ate of this apple or they were disobedient or they did this thing, but it was the reaction that took place in the garden with Adam and Eve. When you care about something and it's hurting, what do you want it to do? Like, I know most of us don't have kids, but like, if you have a pet, like if your pet, like, I don't know, broke its tail or something, right? Do you want it to run from you, or do you want it to run to you? To you. You want to be able to care for it. You want to nurture it. But what do we see in the garden? They felt shame. They tried to cover themselves. They ran from God. When God came into the garden to find them, they hid instead of running to him, right? Now, I'm not saying that everything else that took place was not good or anything like that. But I want to look at a different aspect of the story. I want to look at the same story from just a different lens, right? Everything here is about perception. When do you think we were forgiven? Anybody has any answers? I'm totally open. When were we forgiven? At the cross? At the grave, the resurrection? In the garden, right? How? Why? What leads you to that mentality? What leads you to that thought, right? I know for me, when you look at them, what did Adam and Eve do? When they sinned, they realized they were full of shame, right? They were naked. They tried to make them like halfway like clothes out of fig leaves, right? Plants. Plants break down. Whenever God came to the garden, like we're pretty familiar with the story, when he comes to the garden, he finds out everything happened, he does his thing. He takes better clothes and then clothes them with something better, right? Even in the garden, even in the midst of the sin, God is still showing love. He cares for us. He cares for our well-being, right? He's doing something better for us, even at the moment of that like first sin. The point I want to make right there is God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, right? He loves you unconditionally. That is like the foundation of just my whole thought process here lately, is just that unconditional love that no matter what I do, I cannot separate myself from God's love. He loves me that much. So while we're on the topic of this sin, right, because sin obviously is kind of the root of our issue here, right, where this shame, this guilt, and everything comes from, right, sin, that's kind of like, that's the big struggle that we always have. I want to say something, it's going to sound a little different, so like I said, hear me out, right? I want to take a different approach to sin. I want to take a different look at it, right? I want to see, is there anything about this sin thing that we're missing, right? Like a lot of us here, I grew up with this mentality that, you know, if I sinned, like, it was bad. Like, it was a bad, bad thing, right? There was only negativity brought up with sin, okay? And if I sinned and it separated me from God, like, that was the definition of sin for me kind of growing up, was anything that separates you from God, right? But under grace, like, we've learned, we've understood, and we've gotten enough here that You know, there is nothing that can separate you from God, right? There is no amount of sin in this world, right, that can tear you away from God's love. He is there with you always, right? So these things weren't matching. These things didn't make sense until we understood grace. So what am I missing, you know? Well, if you go back and you look and take another look at sin, sin, in one way, is an archery term, okay, meaning to miss the mark. How many of you are familiar with archery or shooting and stuff like that, right? So you know that there's a black bullseye, okay, 5 points, whatever. And then on the other ring, you know, you've got 4, 3, 2, 1, or however you want to point it out, right? But what sin does not mean is to miss the target. And I set up this illustration because I want to make this point, is that, yeah, five, the bullseye, that's the best, right? We can agree with that. Sure, right? Okay. But is 4 bad? Is 3 bad? 2? I mean, it kind of gets worse and worse, right? But, and then missing the target, you know, that kind of stinks. But it's not necessarily this horrible thing to miss the bullseye, right? But it's not the best, right? And God wants the absolute best for our lives, right? So, if I get a 4 on the rifle range or in an archery tournament, I'm not getting a 4 in an archery tournament, but in the rifle range, do I go home and just beat myself up and tell myself that I'm a horrible person and just fill my life with shame and guilt and everything else because I got a 4? No. I can look at that and go, hey, I've got room for improvement. You know, there's things that I can work on. There's things that I can do, right, to improve my life. And I'm not talking about salvation, all right? I'm just talking about general life. Like, we want to talk about works a lot of times and how just works are just, you know, dead. We don't want to stay away from them, right, until you bring up good works and realize that, yes, there are still things that I can do, right, that are beneficial, right? In the same light, not everything that happens, you know, I have to beat and tear myself up over with this sin thing, right? And I say that because I grew up with sin being this, just such a condemning burden, right? So to be able to bring that burden to a little bit more of a light gives me something I can work with. It takes this mentality of sin from this mental image of shame, of I am stupid, I did, you know, whatever, to, okay, I did something that I can improve on, I can do better at, right? But I don't have to stand here and worry about it. I don't have to feel this condemning nature from God, you know, with the fly swatter going, I'm going to smite you because you did said thing, right? The power of sin, you know, this darkness that is there, you know, we start with guilt and shame, which guilt and shame, how many Star Wars fans do I have here? Out of curiosity. How many real nerds? Like 3. Okay, you'll get this reference, everybody else, sorry. Guilt leads to shame. Shame leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering, right? Okay, no. Somebody, okay, thank you, right? No, guilt and shame lead to more sin. More sin leads to more guilt and shame. It's this revolving circle, right? So where's the end of a circle? Wherever you choose to stop drawing the circle. But usually that takes something coming in and taking over, right? So what stops this power of sin, this revolving thing of what we call pessimism, right? This negativity, what stops that? Whenever you've offended somebody, what gets rid of that offense? Somebody coming in going, sorry, dude, I got you. Don't worry about it, man. So what is that? Love. God's love for you. That's the whole thing here. God's love for you conquers all of that. It covers all of that. There is nothing that can overcome God's love for you. How? I'm going to say this backwards, so hear what I'm meaning, not what I'm saying, right? How can I still sit here and be offended at something when somebody comes up and goes, "You're good, man, don't worry about it"? Are they still upset at me? Are they still mad? No, right? It's me. Anything that comes from that comes from me within, right? Love casts out all of that. And he's done that for us throughout the whole Bible. Stay. Right? He's done that throughout the whole Bible. The whole Bible is filled with God's love. I like to joke with people who don't get that a lot, because they'll go, "Well, if you look at the Old Testament, it's filled with, you know, this guy that's just full of anger and all this other stuff, right? But then all of a sudden he has a baby boy, and now he's all about peace, love, and harmony." You know what? No, the Old Covenant is filled with God's love for us, showing us, right? Take a look at the Ten Commandments, right? First off, if I'm going to be in a position of power, right, first commandment there is what, you know, have no other gods before me, this thing, right? First off, you got to lay a foundation. Hey, I'm building this thing with you, right? This covenant, this old covenant. And then after that, think about those commandments. What are they? Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, honor your father and mother, you know, all these things, right? So if you were to explain love to somebody who has no comprehension of it at all, how do you explain it to them? What are the basic fundamentals of it? Hey, don't lie to people, don't cheat to people, don't steal, don't, you know what I mean? Like, he's laying the foundation of his love to a people who had been in captivity, who all they knew were Egyptian gods for 400 and some odd years, right? So what they knew about God was, do this or I'm going to smite you. Oh, you want rain? Then you need to offer up this sacrifice and do this. So when God created this old covenant, the nation of Israel was supposed to be this nation of priests, okay? Well, what do priests do? They didn't go to war, right? They had direct communication with God, right? Kind of like what we got now, right? So God is using this old covenant. He's meeting the Israelites where they are at, okay? And bringing them into unconditional love where we are now, but he's doing it step by step so that they can follow along and understand, right? We have this veil of the old covenant. I'm going to skip a whole bunch. We have this veil of the old covenant that covered God's unconditional love. We didn't get to see his face. We didn't get to see his true heart, his true nature, right? So when you entered into a covenant in that time frame, right, like, you and me, we're going to enter into a covenant, right? We're two nations, okay? And you've got different kinds of covenants, but we're going to talk specifically about the one that we're in here. We're going to have a small list of rules, okay? And essentially, if you want to bring your people through my land, give me a heads up. You want to trade? We'll trade. We'll have a system set up, that sort of thing. You following along? All right. But if you break those rules, then, you know, your God's going to punish you. If I break the rule, God's going to punish me. He's going to hold me accountable, right? If you go to war as your covenant partner, I'm going to be there for you. I'm going to back you up, vice versa. That's kind of our thing. So when the Israelites get to Mount Sinai, they try to enter into this covenant with God. Basically, God speaks to them, gives them the stuff that we're going to do, and they're like, they go to Moses, and they're like, "All right, dude, check this out. We get God spoke to us," and this is all in Exodus if you want to check it out. "And we didn't die," right? Because like I said, all they knew were these Egyptian angry gods, right? He's like, "We understand that we didn't die. But don't let him talk to us again, because if he does, we probably will," right? Like, they're terrified. They're terrified of God. They don't understand. Their perception of God is that of these old Egyptian gods. They just don't know of the God of love. So he's like, "All right. The other thing that they asked him to do, they said, you know, don't let him talk to us again because he'll probably kill us." He's like, "So you just go find out what he wants, and then we'll do that." And I find it very ironic that he then later has to, you know, the stone tablets, that sort of thing. He's got to take a heart of stone out of them and put in a heart of flesh, which is just symbolic in every way, removing the law and putting in the love of Jesus, the flesh of God, the flesh of Jesus, right? Why? How does this all wrap together? How does this all make sense? The Israelites go to Mount Sinai and they start talking to God, right? Or Moses. And he's like, all right, I'm going to enter into a covenant with you, okay? You're my people. I'm going to be your God. What they would do is they'd take those stone tablets, were written on front and back. So a lot of times the Ten Commandments are displayed as Roman numerals, which is not right, 1 through 5, and then on the other tablets it's 6 through 10. But if you read it, they were written on front and back. They were duplicate copies of the same thing, okay? So on one tablet, it's 1 through 5 on front, 6 through 10 on the back. Duplicate copy. He's holding two copies, right? Each king in this demonstration would go back and take their arks, arks of the covenant, with the modern day pop culture, right? And throw in those arks. And then if they didn't follow the command of that covenant, then their God would hit them with a fly swatter, right? That's like the general the idea of how that works, okay? But God's going, I am God. I don't have a temple. He's like, so you take both my tablets, along with like the manna and Aaron's staff and the other things. And he's like, I'll just be your God, you're my people, and we're going to do this, right? So what would happen is when the Israelites would go to war, because God is righteous, God honors the covenants that he makes, right? When they would go to war, he was their covenant partner. So he would have their back. He would stand with them in battle, right? At the same token, he was their God. So because he's in this covenant with them, when they would break the law that he was made, their deal, he was obligated, because he's righteous, honoring that covenant, to judge them, to do what he said he would do. But people want to look at the old covenant and go, well, God made all these rules so that people would have to follow him, and he was this, you know, dictator basically, yada yada, whatever, you know. And we get this really, really bad perception of what God is, instead of understanding that it was all in love. He was bringing them. Because what happens when Jesus comes? Fast forward, right? He goes, okay, you've got it. You've heard it said, don't kill people. Now I'm going to tell you, don't hate people. He took them a next step in to the new covenant, to love. And then from there, if you remember the story, the disciples asked Jesus, hey, what's the most important commandment? Because they're still stuck in this law mindset, right? And he goes, you know, love God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind, right? And then love your neighbor as yourself, basically, right? Well, how many of us know that sometimes we don't really have a very positive view of ourselves? Not all the time, but sometimes, right? He says the whole law is wrapped up in these two commandments, right? But what we fail to see is that the law, he's still talking about the law. Fast forward to the very, very end, right before Jesus ascends, what does he tell everybody? A new commandment I give you. Love others the way I have loved you. Right? That's, when we talk about the Great Commission the other day, I love that. Go out and all, we teach, well, what are we doing? What are we doing when we go out and we speak to people? We're going out and we're just showing the love of God to other people. Now, how does this fit? How does this make sense? How does this all wrap together? I've not been talking about salvation this entire time. I've just been talking about everything else. The point that I want to show you is that God has always been about love. God has always been about going out and doing good. We're now under grace, we're able to look at each individual scenario in our life, and we don't have to go, is this good, is this bad, right? Paul says that everything's permissible, but not everything is beneficial, right? And he also says, don't be a stumbling block to other people. So if you're looking at yourself and you're feeling condemned because this person over here is looking at you with a perception that says, you know, you can't do this and you have to do this, or this is right and this is wrong. If you're asking the question if something's right or wrong, you're already missing the point. You're missing the point of the love of God, right? Because you can do things, but then if you look at your brother and it's something they struggle with, should you be doing it? No, why? Because you love them, right? Love. Love conquers sin. Like when we're acting out of love for each other, I mean, you can't go wrong. You know what I mean? When we put love at the focal point of everything that we do, unconditional love, when your neighbor, and by neighbor, I don't mean your next door neighbor, I mean like your brother, anybody around you, right, offends you, says something off, they send you that text message. How many of us have gotten that text message that you're just like, I don't know about this one? Because you can't read emotion, right? You can't read into the emotion. But you show them grace. How many times have you gotten like offended about that, gone back, and they're just like, dude, no, I did not mean that at all like that. I meant it like this. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that's right. You know? It's the perception. How you perceive things determines your reality. How you perceive God determines your reality of God. If you've served a God that is holding all of your sins against you and is just sitting there with a fly swatter or a magnifying glass waiting for you to mess up, you're going to live in fear. You're going to live in condemnation. You're going to live in just pessimism. But if you serve a God and you have an understanding of God that is complete, right? You get all the information. Because that's the first thing I talked about, right? Having all the information is the important thing, right? And having a perception, if your perception of God is that of love, and that he's not holding your sins against you, you can walk out your life not living in fear, right? So many Christians, so many people are trying to get to heaven. That is their goal. I just want to get to heaven. When reaching heaven, becoming a citizen of heaven is day one. And then you get to start living the rest of your life as a citizen of heaven, as somebody who's never going to be condemned, who's never going to have to worry about their salvation because they know that they serve a God that loves them and is no longer holding their sins against them.